Welcome to the Endless Knot Podcast,
where the more we know,
the more we want to find out,
tracing serendipitous connections through our lives
and across disciplines.
Hi, I'm Avon.
And I'm Mark.
And today we're talking about pets. So welcome back to The Endless Knot, where we are today really, really going to be actually talking about something light and fluffy.
Pretty much.
Pretty fluffy.
Pretty fluffy.
So yeah, we don't have any major feedback, I don't think, from previous episodes, so we can get right back into it. Today we are going to be talking about pets, though one caveat, neither of us are in any way specialists on this topic. And there is, in fact, quite a lot of work that's been done on animals in the ancient world and animals in the medieval world. So
Absolutely. This
is not going to be comprehensive, but we thought we'd go through some fun facts, fun literature, and fun etymologies for a number of pets from our respective periods. So I'll put links to better sources than us in our show notes. You can investigate further if you want. But first, cocktails.
Indeed.
So this one wasn't too hard for once to find a theme with a cocktail.
There are a fair number, in fact.
Yeah.
Could have gone with.
But I went with one that I've always wanted to try, actually, and just have never had because we don't normally have this juice on hand. So we are having salty dog cocktails, which is essentially, I am told, a greyhound cocktail with a salt rim. Now, a greyhound cocktail is gin and grapefruit juice. And it's the grapefruit juice we don't normally have on hand, so I haven't tried it before. So that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Cheers.
Cheers.
It's nice.
Yeah.
Tastes of grapefruit juice.
And salt.
And salt. Very salty. Mm. But it's nice.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of juice
yeah.
to the amount of gin, so it mostly
yeah.
tastes of grapefruit juice.
Very grapefruity. Mm-hmm.
But since it's actually fresh grapefruit juice, it's actually tasty.
Mm.
Not really a big fan of canned grapefruit juice, which is, I think, why we don't normally make it. All right. Well, if that was refreshing enough to make us ready to get going, shall we begin?
Sure. So we'll start with the word pet itself, and in what will be no doubt a running theme in the etymologies today, the origins of this word are mysterious.
Right.
There are a few theories.
Okay.
So one is that it may be connected somehow, or at least influenced by the word petty.
Mm. Meaning sort of small. And...
small, in the sense of small, which is related to French petit. But that doesn't get us very far because we don't really know where the word petit comes from.
Oh.
It's not a native Latin word.
Huh.
There's a late Latin form that is probably
what
that
it's
word.
From, but where that late Latin
but where comes that comes from is unknown. Some have suggested from a Celtic root. But really, it can't be traced back much further than that. So.
Sorry, I'm just sitting here thinking about the fact that we don't know where the word petit is from.
It's a very common word.
Yeah. And it looks like a Latin word, right? Like it has, I mean, there is a word petitus, but it doesn't mean anything to do with that. So, okay. Just going to contemplate that for a bit. Pet the verb comes from pet the noun?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Pet the verb first appears in 1620s.
Okay.
Also, the sense of a spoilt child goes back quite far.
Oh, right. Like
so
a teacher's
their,
pet kind of idea.
Teacher's pet kind of idea. So the word comes into English, probably from a Scots Gaelic word.
So pet does, okay, so it doesn't just arise in English.
No. So it first arrives in English in Scotland.
Okay.
Because it came from a Scots Gaelic word.
Okay. But we don't know where the Scots Gaelic word goes.
No. So some, to. As I say, some people have connected it to petty maybe, or, you know, some root thereof.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because petit may come from a Celtic word. Okay. Sorry. I didn't. Catch all of these connections the first time through. Getting it now. Right.
That old Irish word is peta. That may be the source of all of these.
Mm-hmm. What does it mean?
It means tame animal.
Okay.
Pet, basically. And also it referring to sometimes to spoiled
child. Right.
So that double sense goes back.
But we can't take it to an Indo-European root. Is that
can't take it back to an Indo-European root unless you believe the alternate theory, which is the one that the Oxford English Dictionary
goes with,
that it probably, as they say, ultimately comes from an extended form of the Proto-Indo-European root, which lies behind the Latin suescere. I don't know why they put it that way, but so it's the third person reflexive.
Suus.
Yeah.
Se.
Su or se. That su or se root. It's sue in Proto-Indo-European, and it gives us all of those reflexive
Yeah, but it, and so somehow that becomes pe?
Yes. Well, Presumably, that's a sound change that happens from Proto-Indo-European into Celtic.
Okay. And maybe that's a change that is known, a sound change.
Yes.
So it would be the reflexive because it's something like connected to myself, something I like, my own.
My animal.
Or her animal.
That's true.
Her own animal.
One's own animal.
I suppose it could be that. His or her own. Yeah.
Yeah.
Still weird.
It is weird. And the OED doesn't explain the semantic shift that lies behind that. So I'm not quite sure
what their reasoning what that is, means. Yeah. Okay, so pet, we don't know where,
it comes from.
But most immediately, it does come from Scots Gaelic.
Yeah, okay. So it first appears in Scots, in Scottish English. That much we know.
Okay.
So as for pets themselves, the other thing that we have to sort of decide on is what is the definition of a pet,
right,
as opposed to any kind of tame mm-hmm. or domesticated animal. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't...
All the range of animals that live in association with humans.
Humans, yeah.
So what makes something a
cattle.
Pet? Yeah.
Cattle we wouldn't really call pets.
Though you could have a pet cow.
You could have a pet cow. And you might have a close relationship to your livestock.
Well, but also like on farms and something, a kid might have a pet calf, right? That they raise for shows and stuff like that.
That's
and they
true.
Think of as being their pet. Mm-hmm. So it's not the fact that it's a cow that makes it completely ineligible to be a pet.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of my point. Mm-hmm. You can have a pet goat, but you could also have a herd of goats that weren't pets.
Right.
Those would be different things. So what is it that distinguishes them?
Well, and I should quote my sources here. There's one particular book that I drew on for this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, her definition of pet, she actually takes from other sources herself or modifies from other sources herself. But I'll just point you to the book that I looked at specifically. Mm-hmm. It's by Kathleen Walker Makel called Medieval Pets.
Mm-hmm.
And so the definition that she sort of goes with, so there's two criteria here. One, it has to be a companion animal serving no purpose other than companionship.
Okay, so no utilitarian purpose.
No utilitarian purpose. And that it lives indoors primarily.
Okay.
Not outdoors or not in a specially purpose-built animal shelter. So like a stable or a pen or a kennel or whatever.
So it doesn't actually have to come, for instance, from the class of domesticated animals.
No.
So it could be a wild animal.
It could be a wild animal kept in a cage.
But it can be a domesticated animal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or a wild animal that's been tamed.
True.
Right. A domesticated animal
yes,
is...
Yes, okay, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So given in particular this notion that pets live indoors, in terms of medieval society, pets tend to belong to or are associated with people who live an indoor life, an indoor lifestyle. And so this is actually a kind of important distinction in terms of medieval society. Women and clerics and so forth live indoor lifestyles.
Mm-hmm.
Lay men tend to live outdoor lifestyles. So their primary activities are warring and hunting.
And farming. Because you're also talking, I think, there's an element here, she may have talked about it, but of class.
Of class.
In lower economic class strata, in more recent years anyway, it's not that people don't ever have pets. They certainly do. Mm-hmm. Children, though, have pets. Adults tend not to have pets that aren't also working animals.
Right.
We'll get to dogs in a moment. So you can have strong affection.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a much smaller incidence of pure pets.
Mm-hmm. To some extent, there probably was sort of pet ownership in lower classes as well, though we don't have enough evidence for it. But the indoor-outdoor distinction still probably makes sense because
you're a
man.
That's why I brought up farming.
Yeah. Whereas women's work
is indoors.
Would be done more indoors. Mm-hmm. So lay men, therefore, were associated with outdoor animals like hunting dogs and horses and so forth.
Hawks,
yeah.
Whereas women are going to be associated with the animals that are usually pets.
Right. That we think of as pets, which we'll get into those types in a minute.
Mm-hmm. The same basically holds true, I think, in the ancient world in terms of who we see having pets and who pets are most associated with. And I will say that I didn't find a source that it was as well conceptualized as you did. There are such things, but I just wasn't able to get my hands on them. So I'm working off my own imperfect knowledge rather than a source here. But in the same way, women and children are the most strongly associated with pets.
Right.
And definitely children.
Right.
That's really important in our sources. And women. But men, there are men who have pets. There do seem to be men who have ornamental pets. But I think that might be because the men who have ornamental pets are very much of the highest classes where there's a leisure element associated with their life.
Right.
That is, I'm thinking of Roman men in particular, where there is a certain amount of sort of conspicuous leisure.
Right.
And though the Romans did go hunting a bit, hunting wasn't as big a deal for them.
Upper class activity.
Yeah, as it wasn't, well, it was upper class. There were upper class, it could be an upper class activity, but it not in the same sort of all-consuming way it was in the medieval period, you know, where like it just became the marker of status. It doesn't have that same, it's a possible leisure activity for the upper classes. So they did have some association with some pet animals, but it is overwhelmingly, I think, women and children who are associated with it. So in the same way, you get that.
Right. In terms of the, well, there is no legal status, basically.
Right. There's no legal distinction
of a pet because they were not considered valuable work animals. Mm. So there were laws that pertained to working animals. They had value. And so you had to be compensated if someone stole a pet, stole a working animal or whatever.
Or hurt it or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Because so they, if they have monetary value like that, then the law is going to regulate it. Right. But since pets didn't have that kind of monetary value, they weren't sort of
compensation setups. Yeah,
yeah, there wasn't really anything in the laws at the time. Now, a relevant issue that would come up surrounding the idea of pets in the medieval world, well, in various ways, the religious implications of pet animals.
Okay. Do dogs have souls?
Do dogs have souls, for instance? So conventionally, the teaching was, at least at first, that animals were thought not to have souls at all. However, some began to argue, including Abelard of Bath, Thomas Aquinas, argued that since they have sensation and some amount of judgment, they have the judgment to desire certain things that are good for them and avoid things that they don't want, they must have some kind of soul, because that doesn't that kind of judgment doesn't reside in the body. It resides in humans, by their belief, in the soul.
This is being driven by the fact that clerics keep pets.
Yes.
Is that basically it, do you think? I mean, well, I mean,
that may be a motivation
realistically,
for it,
that may be part of the reason that they spend time discussing it.
Indeed.
You know, they're fond of their pet and they want to know if they're going to be there in heaven.
And of course, there is lots written about clerics and scholars and so forth owning pets. Should they own pets? Were they allowed to own pets?
Right.
What kind of pets? How they had to be stay out of the sacred places and so forth. So there's a lot of stuff on that.
Yeah.
But in terms of the souls, the sort of final conclusion, therefore, was that they had souls, but they were not immortal souls. So when the animal died, the soul disappears.
Ah, okay. So they aren't going to be in heaven.
They aren't going
to
be in heaven.
All dogs do not go to heaven.
No.
Okay. The idea of whether animals had whatever past soul isn't quite the right word, but, you know, the philosophers in the ancient world certainly did discuss animals. I don't know that they did it in any terms that were specific to pets, though.
Yes, not specific to pets necessarily. But, you know, for instance, Aristotle apparently said animals have souls, but they are mortal souls. So the other way that pets are important in the medieval world is that they become identity markers and become part of the persona, particularly of women.
Okay.
So as a way of establishing what their persona is like, their pet choice, it kind of figures into that.
Okay. So not just a status marker.
Not just a status
marker. But I'm sure that's part of it.
That's part of it, And similarly, to some extent, for clerics. So as identity markers, we therefore see pets in as a kind of iconography in paintings.
Yes.
In
I mean, there's a lot of paintings with,
and
with
so forth.
People lap dogs
their pets. And pets also appear as a motif in representation of lay scholars.
Okay.
So it's not just the cloistered
Not just monks.
Clerics, not just monks, but also lay scholars. It seems to be, you know, I mean, this is the beginning of academic pets, basically.
Right. Academic cats.
Academic cats, yeah.
I mean, so I know academics have other animals, but really, on Twitter anyway, it's just academic cats.
Well, and in fact, in the Middle Ages, too, that was the sort of
obvious
most common pet for a scholar was a cat.
Right. Well, because
there
of
were
the,
other, there were exceptions, but
the activity, non-activity.
Yeah. So there you go. Academic cats goes right back to the Middle Ages. The other kind of purpose that in terms of as kind of identity markers is obviously, as we said, alluded to before, as status markers. So we can see pets as an example, for instance, of conspicuous consumption. They are given special food, not just allowed to, made to, you know, fend for themselves.
Right. They're fed better
than
many humans.
People. Yeah.
You get special cushions to sit on and nice collars. And
and so this then becomes a source of criticism from the church in particular.
Especially because it's women doing it, of course.
Yes.
No, that wasn't a joke. That yeah. was that's where conspicuous consumption is most often
obvious, right?
Well, it's most often criticized by the church.
Right, okay.
Is when women do it.
When women do it, right? Yeah. So, in particular, what the church said is spending all this money on pets and so forth instead of good works, instead of spending it on, you know, charity for the poor, for instance.
As if that was the option. Yeah. As if these people sitting around in their castles were like, I might spend some money on fancy food for my little pet, or I might give it to a poor person. No, that was not the other option. The other option was, or I won't spend it.
Nevertheless, even in the church, it was acknowledged that pets were necessary for companionship, especially for people who lived isolated lives, as both women and clerics did.
Right.
You know,
if
you're in a cloistered community, spend all your time in a cell copying endlessly manuscripts and so forth.
The companionship of an animal was valuable.
Valuable and necessary if that's what your life is. Now, another topic we wanted to come to is mourning for pets.
Mm-hmm. So one reason that's important is because, at least in the ancient world, that's a big source of our understanding of pets. Mm. So in terms of having a source that talks about pets, one of the major sources we have is epitaphs on grave markers, not necessarily for pets, though also for pets.
Pet cemetery.
Well, yeah, but also a lot of representations of dead children with pets. We don't have portraiture from the ancient world for the most part. We have a very, very small amount of it because it doesn't survive. But what we do have is grave markers. Mm-hmm. And grave markers in particular for children are very often represented with a pet. And I think it is iconography for, well, there's a number of things it could be for, but one of the things is it's a marker of childhood. Mm-hmm. Right? It's part of the pathetic element of a grave marker for a child, that it highlights their childhoodness, and probably also is the thing that they had affection for, and it's tied to them. But in the same way that an adult is shown with the tools of his trade sometimes, for instance, or shown in a context that makes it clear he's a senator, or shown, you know, with those things that were important to them in life that show status, children are often shown with pets. But what that means is that one of the major sources we have for what kind of pets were had is what kind of pets are in those grave markers. The other thing, though, is what I think you were thinking of, which is actual epitaphs for pets. So we have a few of those. We have actual grave markers for pets. Not a lot. But the bigger genre was poetic eulogies or epitaphs, poetic epigrams for pets. Dead pets. And this was a whole genre. In particular, it's collected into book, I think, 7 of the Greek Anthology, which is a collection of Hellenistic and Roman era Greek poetry from a whole bunch of different authors. And it's organized by theme in the collection as we have it. And book 7, as I said, I think it's book 7, is pet eulogies. That's all it is. Right. It's like poems about pets. They're not all about them dead, but most of them are. They seem to have grown out of a real genre, but they've become a poetic genre that's often humorous, you know, and is meant to be kind of a parody of actual grave epigrams,
right,
or actual epigrams for dead people, but is sort of parodic and humorous. But some of them are very sort of pathetic and sorrowful too, and so there's a whole bunch of them, and so that becomes a standard genre,
right.
I have some examples of that, which I think you're going to allude to, but I think I'll wait and read them later. But there are some very specific and very famous literary. Greek anthology is literary, but it's doesn't have as high status in terms of later importance.
Mm-hmm.
So the poems I'm thinking of are by Catullus and Martial.
Right.
So we'll come back to those.
And indeed, that genre continued into the Middle Ages. There were a great number of eulogies specifically to the pets of scholars, because they're the ones writing the things down.
Which would make sense, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And these seem to have been very much influenced, very consciously influenced, in particular by Catullus, as well as other writers like Ovid and Statius and Martial. But I want to talk about one specific example of a pet being mourned, just, I guess, slightly late for the Middle Ages. We're kind of getting into the Renaissance here, really. But the pets that belonged to Isabella d'Este, who was a figure who appeared centrally in our most recent video.
On Bellini.
On Bellini. So she was an art patron in the Italian Renaissance.
And your new favorite person.
Yes. She's absolutely fascinating. So her favorite, she had many pets, but her very favorite animal was her pet dog, Aura, A-U-R-A.
Okay.
She was very attached to this dog, and it went with her everywhere in the palace, and her courtiers and ladies-in-waiting could tell she was coming by the sounds of her pets. who would always go around with her.
Was it a little lap dog?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And I'll talk later about specific breeds of dogs that were common. But when this dog died, she was absolutely inconsolable. Mm. And there were many, many, not just like one or two, many, many elegies and epigrams sent to her by various writers around Italy to commemorate this dog.
And her correspondence survives. So we have this.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Right. She had a very prolific correspondence, and all of this gets preserved, so we know a lot about it, including her son, Federico, who wrote her a letter by hand himself, so not written by a secretary or something. Mm-hmm. He wrote personally to his mother to console her and said he was going to send her some kittens to help her. And these letters that reference her grief at the loss of this pet go on for like a year or more. Mm-hmm. So it's not just, she's sad for a month or two or whatever. Mm-hmm. It continued. Mm-hmm. And her son that I mentioned, he was also an avid dog owner, which is unusual for men to be known as pet owners in that way. And what's particularly unusual is that there's a painting of him with a little toy
pet dog.
A little, I mean, it's not a, not a big animal. It's a little toy dog, a little lap dog, with him sort of stroking the animal while the animal has one paw resting on his side. Hmm. It's very touching picture. Yeah. And it's quite unusual in medieval portraiture to have that. Yeah. Renaissance portraiture. Mm-hmm. So that's quite interesting. Painted by Titian. So we can maybe put a picture of that in the... Isabella also had cats, and indeed after the loss of her favorite dog, she seemed to turn to cats then as consolation. Mm. She got these kittens sent by her son. In fact, even before that, she wanted to acquire cats, specifically cats from Syria. And so she had her agents... scouring the markets around Italy.
For Syrian cats
that had been imported from Syria. And so one cat became her sort of favorite. His name was Martino. And again, when he died, she mourned for him quite a bit.
Aww.
So Aura and Martino.
Okay. Two
crucial pets.
Isabella's pets.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of dogs, why don't we turn then to dogs as the first major pet category?
Sure. So we'll start off with etymologies here. We'll start with the most common word for dogs today in English, dog. Again, this is a mystery word. It sort of appeared out of nowhere. And it's actually one of these quite notable mystery words that people always talk about in etymology circles. So the word appears once in late Old English. And then it grows in popularity in the Middle English period. Mm-hmm. That one Old English appearance is in a gloss. So it's not even in running text.
Where it's defined like a gloss of a Latin word?
Of a Latin word, yeah.
Right. So this is where the practice of writing a note next to a word to explain what the word means.
So it glosses Latin canis.
Right. So you know what it is.
We know what it is. It wasn't until the 13th century that the word became popular, and it wasn't really until the 16th century that it replaced the older native word for dog, which is hound.
Right.
As the general word.
Because obviously hound still exists. Yeah.
So it has no known relatives in any European language, except words that borrowed it later. Mm. So all the cognates clearly are borrowing from the English word and come much later. There's no old words that it could be related to.
There's no way at all to say
where it comes from. There's no other...
Right.
There have been some theories, but nothing that's very convincing.
All right, so that's dog.
So that's dog. Now, as I said, the sort of older English word that was the kind of default term for dog, the umbrella term for dog, is hound. Mm-hmm. It appears as hund in Old English. We can trace that back to a root, Proto-Indo-European root quo. Which also is the source of canis.
Which is the Latin. And gives us canine.
Mm-hmm. So that's okay. Interestingly, though, I will point out that from this dog root come a number of other words beside the obvious ones like canine. Mm-hmm. Cynic.
Yes, right. From the Greek for the
from the Greek for the word dog. It's a matter of debate as to why that shift happens.
Well, I mean, we know that it was a word that started to be used of a philosophical sect.
Yes.
And that the word cynic in English comes from the name of that philosophical sect. Why they were called cynics, why they were called dog people, that's the matter of debate.
And there are a number of theories that it might have to do with the nature of that philosophical sect, mm-hmm. that they're somehow doggy in behavior or something, mm-hmm. barking and growling and, you know, that kind of.
Yeah.
The other idea is that it comes from the name of a gymnasium, which was where a particular follower of cynicism taught.
Right.
So that particular gymnasium was called Kynosarge. Who knows
where that
actually comes from. Another word that surprisingly comes from the Latin word canis, mm-hmm. is canary. So another possible pet, as it turns out.
Right.
So the way this happens is it comes from the Canary Islands. So that island was...
The set of islands.
That set of islands.
In the Atlantic.
Originally received that Latin name because they found wild dogs living there.
Right. So the dog islands.
Yeah. Later on, the island was noted for this particular bird that lived on the island. Mm-hmm. And so that bird then therefore came to be known as canaries because they're the birds from the Canary Islands. I just like the fact that it's another pet.
Yeah. Well, and it is not intuitive at all that birds would be named after dogs because they're not named after dogs. They're named after the place.
Yeah.
So canary yellow is dog yellow, the color.
Yes, I guess that's true.
Which is a yellow dog, which is a whole other kind of thing. Yeah.
So did you have anything specific to say about dogs in the ancient world?
Well, yes. So dogs are obviously a major type of pets. Now, they do straddle this line. Mm-hmm. There are lots and lots of dogs in the ancient world that are hunting dogs. Mm-hmm. So that's their main employment mm-hmm. in the ancient world, as it is later. And we have a fair number of famous hunting dogs. They are also, though, pets. Now, this is where there is that fuzzy line, because there are certainly men who have hunting dogs that they are very affectionate towards, mm-hmm. that have strong affectionate ties. The most famous of those is in the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows this one, but I'm going to read it anyway, because I asked on Twitter for people's favorite pets.
Right.
And more than one person mentioned this passage, especially Demetrian Cassis brought it up, among others, for instance. So famously, when Odysseus comes back from his travels, he's in disguise and he comes to his palace for the first time in disguise. No one knows except for his son. And he is disguised as a beggar. And as he comes into the palace in disguise to begin to wreak his vengeance on the suitors, he's talking to someone in the courtyard. And I'll read the Emily Wilson translation of the New Odyssey, mm-hmm. our earlier episode. Mm-hmm. interview with her. So as they're speaking in the courtyard, as they spoke, Argos, the dog that lay there, raised his head and ears. Odysseus had trained this dog, but with no benefit. He left too soon to march on holy Troy. The master gone, the boys took the puppy out to hunt wild goats and deer and hares. But now he lay neglected, without an owner, in a pile of dung from mules and cows. The slaves stored heaps of it outside the door until they fertilized the large estate. So Argos lay there, dirty, covered with fleas. And when he realized Odysseus was near, he wagged his tail and both his ears dropped back. He was too weak to move towards his master. At a distance, Odysseus had noticed, and he wiped his tears away and hid them easily, and said, "Eumaeus, it is strange this dog is lying in the dung. He looks quite handsome, though it is hard to tell if he can run or if he is a pet, a table dog, kept just for looks." "Eumaeus, you replied, this dog belonged to someone who has died in foreign lands. If he were in good health, as when Odysseus abandoned him and went to Troy, you soon would see how quick and brave he used to be. He went to hunt in woodland, and he always caught his prey. His nose was marvelous. But now he is in bad condition, with his master gone, long dead. The women failed to care for him. Slaves do not want to do their proper work when masters are not watching them. Zeus halves our value on the day that makes us slaves." With that, the swineherd went inside the palace to join the noble suitors. 20 years had passed since Argos saw Odysseus, and now he saw him for the final time. Then suddenly, Black Death took hold of him. That's his one little cameo, mm-hmm. but there are many people who said, "Oh, that always makes me cry." Mm-hmm. He's there. I mean, it's important to the poem in all sorts of ways. You know, the first recognition token that it really is Odysseus,
right.
and the pathos and all of this stuff. It's, you know, there's all sorts of reasons that he should be there. But nonetheless, what we have there is that, yes, he's a hunting dog, mm-hmm. but It's the bond of affection mm-hmm. between the two of them. And interesting that Odysseus says, is he a hunting dog or just a pet, kept just for looks? So even in the Odyssey, we have that suggestion that he could be just a pet.
I wonder what the Greek word used there is.
Would you like me to look at it? Look. All right. So having looked it up, the words in Greek, there's no specific word for a pet.
Okay.
What there is it says very literally, you know, is this a swift and good hunting dog mm-hmm. or one of those sorts of dog fed at the table that people have?
Right. Okay.
One who is there to be good looking. So the phrase trapezes kunes is table fed dogs.
Table fed dogs.
And trapez, that comes from the word a table, trapeze. So that's not a specific word for pet. Mm. Or pet dog even. But that is, apparently it appears more than once as a phrase in Homer. So there was a category of dogs kept and fed at the table, as opposed to in a kennel. So that gets you that interior, inside element of the house.
Right.
Pet, right? Like that's a house pet. It's fed at the table rather than fed in the kennels, like a normal hound dog would be.
By the way, did you know we get the word trapeze from trapeze?
Well, I've always assumed so.
Even though it's not
a table in any sense?
A table in any sense.
I mean, where else could it possibly come from?
Also, trapezoid.
Yeah.
That makes a little more sense in some ways.
Yeah, it does.
The trapeze is because the arrangement of the ceiling, the two lines that come down from the ceiling, and the bar that the...
Make a trapezoid. And a trapezoid is named that because it looks like...
Well, with the legs and the top. It's like...
And the floor.
It's that shape.
Right. So anyway, so that's sort of the most famous, in a way, pet dog, even though he's not a pet dog in literature. But there's also a wonderful list in Ovid that I won't read, but Actaeon goes hunting in the Metamorphoses of Ovid with his pack of hunting dogs.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone is named. There's this big, long catalog of the names of his dogs. And they're all named, and they have these wonderful, you know, really speaking names. Mm-hmm. Swifty and Fast Catcher and Wind and all this. But in truly Ovidian twist, the reason, and he loves his dogs, and the reasons they're so lovingly named and described is because later in this myth, of course, they're going to tear him to pieces because he's going to be turned into a deer, and he's going to be torn apart by his own dogs. Yeah. So that's why we have this concentration on them. So that's another passage somebody brought up on Twitter. No, those are very much hunting dogs, though, not pets. As pets, there were also lap dogs, definitely lap dogs. And in Roman period in particular, we have a fair amount of images of that, but also in earlier periods. Mm-hmm. The most favored lap dog was the Meletian, which was from Africa, probably from Carthaginian Africa, and imported to Malta or maybe somewhere else, which is why it's got
the
name.
The name means Malta. Yep.
Yeah, Maltese. And that seems to have been the sort of favorite, but there are other kinds as well. There is a poem by Marshall on a pet dog that I will read to you because it's a kind of typical. This is Marshall 1109 about the dog Issa. Issa is more playful than the sparrow of Catullus. We'll come back to Catullus and his sparrow. Issa is more pure than the kiss of a dove. Issa is more loving than any maiden. Issa is dearer than Indian gems. The little dog Issa is the pet of Publius. So that's a man or boy, anyway. Mm-hmm. If she complains, you will think she speaks. She feels both the sorrow and the gladness of her master. She lies reclined upon his neck and sleeps so that not a respiration is heard from her. And, however pressed, she has never sullied the coverlet with a single spot. But rouses her master with a gentle touch of her foot and begs to be set down from the bed and relieved. Such modesty resides in this chaste little animal. She knows not the pleasures of love, nor do we find a mate worthy of so tender a damsel. That her last hour may not carry her off wholly, Publius has her limbed in a picture, so painted, in which you will see an Issa so like that not even herself is so like herself. In a word, place Issa and the picture side by side, and you will imagine either both real or both painted. So, the point of the poem really is this conceit of the lifelike painting. But I think if you had any doubt at all that in antiquity there were pets, dogs, that is a pet dog for sure. And seems to be of a man, for the record. Mm-hmm. So I just thought I'd give you that. And then this idea of dogs being a marker of status and also memorialized in the Satyricon by Petronius, and in the section with Trimalchio, Trimalchio's Dinner, which is a parody of this jumped up freedman who got really rich and is all crass and everything. He, at one point, the big long section of this story is about, he starts imagining his own funeral and he tells you everything that's going to happen. He ends up like play acting his own funeral. But at the beginning of it, he says, he's talking to his friends and says, here's what I want you to do for my funeral. I beg you earnestly to put round the feet of my statue, when I'm dead, my little dog. And then later he says, on my right hand, put a statue of dear Fortunata, his wife, holding a dove, and let her be leading a little dog with a waistband on, which is probably a collar, but they seem to have around the belt, middle, the middle instead of around the neck. So we have the idea that his grave is going to be, like I said before, marked with him with his pet and his wife with her pets, a dove and a dog. So just thought those were two good extracts to tell you about.
Well, in the Middle Ages, dogs were the most common pet, by far. And indeed, the most common breed of dogs is the same that you mentioned, the Maltese. And in fact, you can see a picture of such a dog in the very famous Lady and the Unicorn tapestries.
Right.
One of the tapestries shows a little Maltese, very clearly a little white lap dog. So that's very clear what breed it is, sitting on a brocade cushion. Also, interestingly, in that set of tapestries, you can see a pet monkey.
We'll come to monkeys in a moment.
We'll come to monkeys later. Another possible breed of dog that was known in the Middle Ages is the Spaniel. So-called because it was supposedly of Spanish origin.
Right.
Now, in terms of beliefs about dogs in the Middle Ages, the first place to look, obviously, is the Bible. And in the Bible, dogs are mostly negative in association. The one exception to this is in the Book of Tobit, in which Tobias is accompanied by his faithful pet dog as he searches to find a cure for his father's blindness.
There's one good dog. Yeah. Otherwise, mostly in the Bible, dogs appear only when they tear people to pieces, right?
Yeah,
or they
yeah.
eat corpses and things. They're a threat.
Yeah.
Throwing you to the dogs.
Now, in medieval literary contexts, Hildegard von Bingen writes about a number of different pet animals. And of dogs, she claims that dogs can prognosticate.
Okay.
She would be the expert on this, I suppose.
What? Weirdo theories.
And she said that the devil hates dogs because of their loyalty to humans.
Okay. So she thinks dogs do go to heaven.
I guess. Another belief about dogs in the Middle Ages is that they were believed to be able to identify their master's murderer. And so there are some historical records of this actually happening. This being so when someone had mysteriously died and then a dog
attacked someone,
the dog belonging to the dead man attacked someone or was aggressive towards someone, he was accused of the murder. And so there's a number of interesting stories about that kind of thing. And of course, dogs are known for their loyalty and devotion right up to the point of death. You know, they won't leave their owner and remain by their grave. The interesting thing to note, though, is all these stories about dogs' devotion to their masters is always to their masters, not to women. There are no stories of that particularly highlight the faithfulness of the dog when it's a woman who's the owner.
Right. Even though they mostly had the pets.
Yeah. In sort of kind of more literary type of texts, a pet, especially a dog, is often pictured as the comfort for a lady given to her by her lover in medieval romances.
For when he's not there, she
needs a, you know, comforting animal. And often he gives her the animal. And
it sort of stands in as his surrogate. Not literally.
And the most famous example of this is in the various romances of Tristan and Isolde. And so there are different versions of this romance. In some versions, the dog even has kind of magical powers and things. It's quite significant to the story. But that's not the literary example I want to particularly stress. That's a pretty well-known one. The one I want to stress is perhaps a little less well-known, is the dog in Njal's saga. The dog is called Sam, or really, it's Saumur.
Tell people what Njal's saga is.
So Njal's saga is an Old Norse family saga, a saga of the Icelanders, that tells the story of, you know, generations of people in Iceland and their various things that they get
mostly
up to.
Mostly revenge.
Revenge. Yeah, this one in particular is a series of revenges.
Yeah.
And the dog's name is Sam. Well, that's how we always said it. But of course, it's not related to Samuel or anything like that. It's actually the Norse word Samur, which means dark colored. Mm. And in fact, it's a personal name too.
Right. Oh, Argos, I should have said in the Odyssey, means swift.
Swift. Okay.
Or maybe white.
Okay.
There's a little white shining. There's a little debate on that.
Debate on that. Well, in this Norse saga, this dog is given to one of the main characters, Gunnar, by someone named Olafur Pai, who is descended from the Irish king Myrkjartan.
Okay. So the person who gives the dog is descended from
descended
an Irish king.
An Irish king. Okay. Yeah. So this dog is an Irish dog, therefore. Right. And he says, I want to give you three gifts, a gold bracelet, a cloak that once belonged to King Myrkjartan of Ireland, and a dog I was given in Ireland. He was a big animal and will make as good a comrade in arms as a powerful man. He has human intelligence, and he will bark at every man he recognizes as your enemy, but never at your friends. He can tell from a man's face whether he means you well or not. He would lay down his life rather than fail you. His name is Sam.
So
he is this sort of psychic dog or something.
Right.
And so Gunnar's enemies realize they have to get rid of this dog because they're trying to bump him off.
Right.
And the dog is
stopping them.
Is stopping them, is saving them all the time. So they basically set up this sort of ploy using someone. They force someone that he knows to be a distraction, and the dog doesn't bark at him, and then they're able to kill the dog. And so I'll just read you that little passage. Onund of Trollwood drove his axe deep into the dog's head, right down to the brain. The animal uttered a loud howl, the like of which none had ever heard before, and fell down dead. Inside the house, Gunnar woke up. You have been harshly treated, Sam, my fosterling, he said. It may well be fated that my turn is coming soon.
And is he then burned inside his house?
That's Njal.
No, it's Njal who gets Njal burned who inside gets his house. Yes. Aw, poor Sam.
Poor Sam, yeah.
He might have been a wolfhound then, eh?
Yeah, that's the presumption.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big Irish dog.
Big Irish dog, yeah. So, yeah, that story has always stayed with me since I read it as a master's student.
Yeah, I seem to remember you telling me about that when you were in grad school. Sam the dog.
Sam the dog. I felt so sad when he died.
Yeah, well, see, the Odyssey's Argos and Sam the dog, right? There's a connection there.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, guys. So while editing this, I realized that it was very long. The raw audio was 2 hours for this topic. We had a lot to say about pets. So for my sake and yours, I've decided to break it into 2 episodes. So I'm going to stop here. We've talked about pets in general and dogs. Next episode, which will be out in 2 weeks, will cover cats and a variety of other, possibly more unusual pets that the ancient and medieval world enjoyed keeping. So look for that. It'll be the continuation. There won't be a new cocktail because it's just the same conversation, but that will be coming in 2 weeks. In the meantime, go out and pet your pets. For more information on this podcast, check out our website, www.alliterative.net, where you can find links to the videos, blog posts, sources, and credits, and all our contact info.
And please check out our Patreon, where you can pledge to support this show and our video project. You can go directly to the videos at youtube.com/alliterative.
Our email is on the website, but the easiest way to get in touch with us is Twitter. I'm at AvenSarah, AvenSarah.
And I'm at alliterative. To keep up with the podcast, subscribe on your favorite podcast app or to the feed on the website.
And if you've enjoyed it, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It helps us a lot. We'll be back soon with more musings about the connections around us. Thanks for listening.
Bye.